Scottish Qualifications Authority, National Qualifications 2019, English for Speakers of Other Languages, National 5, Listening. Recording 1. Listen to the recording and attempt the questions which follow. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in recording 1 before the recording begins.
So wrap up warm, because it looks like we're in for another frosty day. Now, with a lack of cash and resources, emergency services are trying to cut nuisance 999 calls. But how do they stop some callers wasting their time? Here with me in the studio is Chief Superintendent Singh from Police Scotland's Contact, Command and Control Unit. Good morning, Chief Superintendent.
Good morning.
Are the time wasters really putting the lives of genuine emergency callers at risk?
Yes, definitely. Misuse, hoax and nuisance calls all divert resources away from genuine emergencies. But our phone operators can usually see what needs to be taken seriously and what should be set aside. They're trained to recognise these types of calls.
What kind of hoax calls do they deal with?
Everything and anything. One caller rang 999 to complain about the sprinkles on her ice cream. Another was from a man complaining he'd been given a hamburger instead of a cheeseburger at a fast food restaurant. We also get nuisance callers ringing 999 over and over again. The most frequent nuisance callers are looked at each day, with officers focusing on the top 10 in each area and making prosecutions where appropriate. Our operators are also trained to recognise nuisance callers who might suffer from mental health issues, as this can be a factor.
And what about misuse calls?
Some examples of misuse calls are someone reporting a chicken walking down the road, the theft of a packet of crisps, and a person who wanted to know if the green part of a potato was poisonous. More commonly, we have people dialing 999 for minor ailments like colds and toothache.
Hardly emergencies, then. Surely it's common sense that calls like those shouldn't be made to 999.
We need everyone to understand that the emergency services are not an information service and that you should only call 999 when a life is in danger, a crime is in progress, or a suspect is nearby. We're trying to build up awareness of what's appropriate, but sometimes it's not so clear. There was a case recently where a 15-year-old girl became trapped in a cat flap. She'd returned home in the early hours of the morning without her house keys, and so she tried to squeeze herself through the small hole, but got stuck. She called the Scottish Fire and Rescue Service to ask them to free her.
It's well known that the fire service now charges for non-emergency calls.
That's right. You'll now be charged several hundred pounds if you make a non-emergency call. Its resources are extremely stretched and it has to focus on saving lives in fire and traffic incidents and not being called out to things such as people being locked out and cats stuck up trees.
So, did the girl stuck in the cat flap get a huge bill?
I understand that in this case the girl wasn't charged because the service's fire control decided if there had been a fire while she was still stuck, her life would have been at risk. But in most cases you'd expect people to use the 101 non-emergency number.
So where do the emergency services draw the line?
It depends on the detail of the incident, if callers are charged or not, and there's variation nationally on this. Fire services tend to charge for call-outs in which there's some element of blame rather than an accident. So if, for example, a load fell off a lorry because it wasn't tied on properly, the company would be charged because it used resources at public expense and it was avoidable.
I've seen the emergency services often release online videos of time-wasting calls they receive. Does that make a difference?
It's made a big difference as it makes people think twice before calling 999. Since releasing these, we've received far fewer misuse or hoax 999 calls and seen a huge increase in calls to the non-emergency number 101.
That's good news.
And we hope the release of examples of inappropriate calls combined with our public education initiatives will help underline the message 999 is for genuine emergencies only.
Thank you, Chief Superintendent Singh of Police Scotland. So wrap up warm because it looks like we're in for another frosty day. Now, with a lack of cash and resources, emergency services are trying to cut nuisance 999 calls. But how do they stop some callers wasting their time? Here with me in the studio is Chief Superintendent Singh from Police Scotland's Contact, Command and Control Unit. Good morning, Chief Superintendent.
Good morning.
Are the time wasters really putting the lives of genuine emergency callers at risk?
Yes, definitely. Misuse, hoax and nuisance calls all divert resources away from genuine emergencies. But our phone operators can usually see what needs to be taken seriously and what should be set aside. They're trained to recognise these types of calls.
What kind of hoax calls do they deal with?
Everything and anything. One caller rang 999 to complain about the sprinkles on her ice cream. Another was from a man complaining he'd been given a hamburger instead of a cheeseburger at a fast food restaurant. We also get nuisance callers ringing 999 over and over again. The most frequent nuisance callers are looked at each day, with officers focusing on the top 10 in each area and making prosecutions where appropriate. Our operators are also trained to recognise nuisance callers who might suffer from mental health issues, as this can be a factor.
And what about misuse calls?
Some examples of misuse calls are someone reporting a chicken walking down the road, the theft of a packet of crisps, and a person who wanted to know if the green part of a potato was poisonous. More commonly, we have people dialing 999 for minor ailments like colds and toothache.
Hardly emergencies then. Surely it's common sense that calls like those shouldn't be made to 999.
We need everyone to understand that the emergency services are not an information service and that you should only call 999 when a life is in danger, a crime is in progress, or a suspect is nearby. We're trying to build up awareness of what's appropriate, but sometimes it's not so clear. There was a case recently where a 15-year-old girl became trapped in a cat flap. She'd returned home in the early hours of the morning without her house keys, and so she tried to squeeze herself through the small hole, but got stuck. She called the Scottish Fire and Rescue Service to ask them to free her.
It's well known that the fire service now charges for non-emergency calls.
That's right. You'll now be charged several hundred pounds if you make a non-emergency call. Its resources are extremely stretched and it has to focus on saving lives in fire and traffic incidents and not being called out to things such as people being locked out and cats stuck up trees.
So, did the girl stuck in the cat flap get a huge bill?
I understand that in this case the girl wasn't charged because the service's fire control decided if there had been a fire while she was still stuck, her life would have been at risk. But in most cases you'd expect people to use the 101 non-emergency number.
So where do the emergency services draw the line?
It depends on the detail of the incident, if callers are charged or not, and there's variation nationally on this. Fire services tend to charge for call-outs in which there's some element of blame rather than an accident. So if, for example, a load fell off a lorry because it wasn't tied on properly, the company would be charged because it used resources at public expense and it was avoidable.
I've seen the emergency services often release online videos of time-wasting calls they receive. Does that make a difference?
It's made a big difference as it makes people think twice before calling 999. Since releasing these, we've received far fewer misuse or hoax 999 calls and seen a huge increase in calls to the non-emergency number 101.
That's good news.
And we hope the release of examples of inappropriate calls combined with our public education initiatives will help underline the message 999 is for genuine emergencies only.
Thank you, Chief Superintendent Singh of Police Scotland.
Recording 2. Listen to the recording and attempt the questions which follow. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in recording 2 before the recording begins.
Right, good morning. As you can see, we have a guest on the course today. This is Catherine Bryden from Wilson Worldwide Recruitment, and today she's going to give you some tips about something that's becoming more and more common in business, the Skype interview. Good morning, Catherine.
Hi, and hello to all of you. It's really nice to be here in college instead of being stuck in the office. Let me start by talking about the company I work for, Wilson Worldwide Recruitment. Or WWR. Well, the clue is in the name. We try to match people with jobs all over the world, which means that both the applicants and the jobs can be anywhere. A lot of companies aren't able to deal with applicants that live far away, so we provide a service. We can manage the whole interview process for them, or just a part of it. This is something the client has to decide. Let's say there's a company in London, and they get an application from a candidate in Sweden. We can do the Skype interview and hand over the video to the company. If they like the look of this candidate, the next thing might be a face-to-face interview in Sweden with one of our people. This will be videoed and given to the company, and only after that they might fly the applicant to London. However, there are a few clients who will hire just because of the videos and the recommendation that we give to them. Of course, we charge a fee for the services we provide. Now, there's nothing to stop the company doing a Skype interview themselves, but, well, time is money. They might have trouble setting up the technology. they might not be very good at interviewing, our people are experts, and very often they find it simpler and more cost-effective to pay us to do the whole process. That's how we stay in business. So, you can see that Skype is very likely going to be a part of your experience as you move towards employment. Therefore, I'm going to move on to some tips on how to do a good Skype interview. Let's start with the clothes you wear. The rule is you dress as you would for a face-to-face interview, which would mean formally. And don't just think about what you wear above the waist. I've seen some interviews where the candidate has had to stand up. In one case, this was a bit embarrassing, as she was wearing her pyjamas. The surroundings are also important. The rule is to keep things simple. A plain wall behind you, no pot plants, and definitely no unwashed cups or water bottles on the desk. Think about your position too. Set yourself up so the interviewer can see your face, hair, shoulders, and upper body. And give some thought to the lighting. They don't want a giant, poorly lit face talking at them for an hour. The technology is important too, of course. I'd advise you to practice before. Someone I know never practiced with anyone and everything possible went wrong. He was at a strange angle to the screen. Worst of all, the microphone wasn't working well. And rather than listening to the questions, he spent most of the time fiddling with the settings. The picture was flickering and kept freezing as his internet connection was unreliable and his dog was barking in the background. The whole thing was a disaster. You need to be confident with the technology and just concentrate on the interview.
Well, thanks a lot, Catherine. That seems to have covered everything. Now, can we have some questions from the group? Yes, Anna. Right, good morning. As you can see, we have a guest on the course today. This is Catherine Bryden from Wilson Worldwide Recruitment, and today she's going to give you some tips about something that's becoming more and more common in business, the Skype interview. Good morning, Catherine.
Hi, and hello to all of you. It's really nice to be here in college instead of being stuck in the office. Let me start by talking about the company I work for, Wilson Worldwide Recruitment, or WWR. Well, the clue is in the name. We try to match people with jobs all over the world, which means that both the applicants and the jobs can be anywhere. A lot of companies aren't able to deal with applicants that live far away, so we provide a service. We can manage the whole interview process for them, or just a part of it. This is something the client has to decide. Let's say there's a company in London, and they get an application from a candidate in Sweden. We can do the Skype interview and hand over the video to the company. If they like the look of this candidate, the next thing might be a face-to-face interview in Sweden with one of our people. This will be videoed and given to the company, and only after that they might fly the applicant to London. However, there are a few clients who will hire just because of the videos and the recommendation that we give to them. Of course, we charge a fee for the services we provide. Now, there's nothing to stop the company doing a Skype interview themselves, but, well, time is money. They might have trouble setting up the technology. They might not be very good at interviewing. Our people are experts, and very often they find it simpler and more cost-effective to pay us to do the whole process. That's how we stay in business. So, you can see that Skype is very likely going to be a part of your experience as you move towards employment. Therefore, I'm going to move on to some tips on how to do a good Skype interview. Let's start with the clothes you wear. The rule is you dress as you would for a face-to-face interview, which would mean formally. And don't just think about what you wear above the waist. I've seen some interviews where the candidate has had to stand up. In one case, this was a bit embarrassing, as she was wearing her pyjamas. The surroundings are also important. The rule is to keep things simple. A plain wall behind you, no pot plants, and definitely no unwashed cups or water bottles on the desk. Think about your position too. Set yourself up so the interviewer can see your face, hair, shoulders and upper body. And give some thought to the lighting. They don't want a giant, poorly lit face talking at them for an hour. The technology is important too, of course. I'd advise you to practice before. Someone I know never practiced with anyone and everything possible went wrong. He was at a strange angle to the screen. Worst of all, the microphone wasn't working well. And rather than listening to the questions, he spent most of the time fiddling with the settings. The picture was flickering and kept freezing as his internet connection was unreliable and his dog was barking in the background. The whole thing was a disaster. You need to be confident with the technology and just concentrate on the interview.
Well, thanks a lot, Catherine. That seems to have covered everything. Now, can we have some questions from the group? Yes, Anna.
Recording 3. Listen to the recording and attempt the questions which follow. You will hear the recording twice. You now have 1 minute to read the questions in recording 3 before the recording begins.
So, now on Radio Nation, it's time for Free to Think. Apparently, I'm a part of what we now call Generation X. To explain that, meet my first guest, Ashley Collins, a lecturer in sociology at the University of Aberclyde. Welcome, Ashley.
Hi, Michael.
Tell us about Generation X.
Well, if you were born in 1970, it probably means that your parents were part of the large number of babies that followed the Second World War, born after 1945. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay, so that makes you part of Generation X. Now, the post-war generation wanted a different world. They rebelled against their parents. They questioned traditional values. They often got divorced and the women wanted careers. They're quite old now, but they've been a very influential generation.
Good for them. But what about my generation?
Well, Generation X is sometimes called the latchkey generation, meaning they often came home to an empty house and had to use their own key to get in. Because their parents weren't protesting against nuclear weapons, or having careers, or were separated, and so on.
Actually, I don't think I'm typical, because both my parents are still married, and I had a fairly stable childhood. But I've got two kids, and what interests me now is that their generation, sometimes called Generation Y, is also being called the Snowflake Generation. But before we get into that, let me introduce my second guest, Craig Ritchie. Hi, Craig.
Hi, Michael. Nice to be back. Ashley, good to meet you.
You too, Craig. I read some of your articles.
Yes, Craig's a freelance journalist, and I know this area is something that interests him. In fact, you've got a book coming out about it, haven't you?
I have.
Craig, tell us about the Snowflake Generation. Does it mean that their parents took them skiing?
Well, some did, of course, but no. The point about snowflakes is that everyone is unique, and the idea is that your generation has been overprotective of your children. Everyone's been treated as their parents' precious little snowflake, driven to school and to and from clubs and social events, and not given the chance to just do stuff on their own.
You might be overdoing it a bit here. I mean, it's certainly not true of the way my wife and I brought up our kids. We always encouraged them to be independent, and I know that's true of other parents. But I'll take your general point. What are the consequences?
Well, one thing that seems to happen is the ones that go to university find it a bit scary. Maybe for the first time in their lives, they come across ideas that are very different from the ones they heard at school.
Well, university has always been a new experience, but there's certainly a different atmosphere on campuses these days. We hear calls for a safe space.
Safe space? Could you define that?
It's the idea that students shouldn't be exposed to things like racism or sexism, whoever they are. They should be able to feel comfortable.
Well, that's fair. Nobody should have to cope with that kind of thing on campus or elsewhere.
But some universities have taken this further, and it's led to some speakers being barred from campuses because their ideas are seen as controversial.
Well, I can remember examples of that when I was at university.
True, it did happen. But the speakers that were concerned then were more extreme, I'd say. It's a question of degree. And it seems to be a trend that's increasing, and I'd say that's a threat to the whole idea of free speech.
Well, Craig, I'm afraid I'm going to have to put an end to your free speech for the moment, because it's time for some music. Here's Oasis covering My Generation, live in Manchester. So, now on Radio Nation, it's time for Free to Think. Apparently, I'm a part of what we now call Generation X. To explain that, meet my first guest, Ashley Collins, a lecturer in sociology at the University of Aberclyde. Welcome, Ashley.
Hi, Michael.
Tell us about Generation X.
Well, if you were born in 1970, it probably means that your parents were part of the large number of babies that followed the Second World War, born after 1945. Is that true?
Yes.
Okay, so that makes you part of Generation X. Now, the post-war generation wanted a different world. They rebelled against their parents. They questioned traditional values. They often got divorced and the women wanted careers. They're quite old now, but they've been a very influential generation.
Good for them. But what about my generation?
Well, Generation X is sometimes called the latchkey generation, meaning they often came home to an empty house and had to use their own key to get in. Because their parents weren't protesting against nuclear weapons, or having careers, or were separated and so on.
Actually, I don't think I'm typical, because both my parents are still married, and I had a fairly stable childhood. But I've got two kids, and what interests me now is that their generation, sometimes called Generation Y, is also being called the Snowflake Generation. But before we get into that, let me introduce my second guest, Craig Ritchie. Hi, Craig.
Hi, Michael. Nice to be back. Ashley, good to meet you.
You too, Craig. I read some of your articles.
Yes, Craig's a freelance journalist, and I know this area is something that interests him. In fact, you've got a book coming out about it, haven't you?
I have.
Craig, tell us about the Snowflake Generation. Does it mean that their parents took them skiing?
Well, some did, of course, but no. The point about snowflakes is that everyone is unique, and the idea is that your generation has been overprotective of your children. Everyone's been treated as their parents' precious little snowflake, driven to school and to and from clubs and social events, and not given the chance to just do stuff on their own.
You might be overdoing it a bit here. I mean, it's certainly not true of the way my wife and I brought up our kids. We always encouraged them to be independent, and I know that's true of other parents. But I'll take your general point. What are the consequences?
Well, one thing that seems to happen is the ones that go to university find it a bit scary. Maybe for the first time in their lives, they come across ideas that are very different from the ones they heard at school.
Well, university has always been a new experience, but there's certainly a different atmosphere on campuses these days. We hear calls for a safe space.
Safe space? Could you define that?
It's the idea that students shouldn't be exposed to things like racism or sexism, whoever they are. They should be able to feel comfortable.
Well, that's fair. Nobody should have to cope with that kind of thing on campus or elsewhere.
But some universities have taken this further, and it's led to some speakers being barred from campuses because their ideas are seen as controversial.
Well, I can remember examples of that when I was at university.
True, it did happen. But the speakers that were concerned then were more extreme, I'd say. It's a question of degree. And it seems to be a trend that's increasing, and I'd say that's a threat to the whole idea of free speech.
Well, Craig, I'm afraid I'm going to have to put an end to your free speech for the moment, because it's time for some music. Here's Oasis covering My Generation, live in Manchester.
You now have 1 minute to check your answers.
This is the end of the listening test.